This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. So, you're immune to marketing and advertising, right? Brands mean nothing to you, right? Well, Rob Walker says don't be so quick to answer those questions in the affirmative. Walker, who writes the column Consumed for the New York Times magazine, argues our choices as consumers are conscious expressions of who we are. He says we as consumers play a role in marketing. In his words, any product or brand that catches on in the marketplace does so because of us, because enough of us decided that it had value or meaning and chose to participate. Rob Walker then sees us as creating or helping to create a brand's meaning. How does this happen? Why does it happen? It led Walker to coin a new word to describe what's going on. The word is merketing, a combo of murky and marketing. Rob Walker explores merketing in his new book, Buying In, the Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. Rob Walker is our guest this afternoon. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest before joining the New York Times to write the column Consumed. He created and wrote a column for Slate called Ad Report Card. In addition to Buying In, he is the author of Letters from New Orleans. His website is merketing.com. His new book, Buying In, the Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are, is published by Random House. Again, listeners, if you'd like to talk with the New York Times Magazine columnist, Rob Walker, give us a call, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Rob Walker, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, merketing is made up of two words, and when you first coined it, you meant it at least in part as a joke. When and how did you make up the word?
It originally came about, or I started thinking about this word back when I was doing some early reporting on the arrival of Red Bull, the energy drink, in the United States market. It had been established overseas, but came into the U.S. market in around 2000-2001 and did so in this unusual way where usually a big product like that that was really introducing a whole new concept, energy drinks didn't really exist in the United States market. And, you know, usually throughout the history of marketing, what you would do is something pretty splashy, pretty direct, saying here's what this is, here's who it's for, and here's why it's good, you know, most obviously in the form of 30-second ads during primetime television. And Red Bull did the opposite thing, and at first I just couldn't figure it out. Their strategy seemed so murky that they were just doing a lot of these small events. They were inconsistent in terms of the kinds of people that they were targeting, and they were never really saying what, you know, the functional benefit was in any direct way. The main sales pitch is right there on the can. It says, with taurine. Well, what's taurine? No one really knew. A lot of rumors flew around about that. The company just sort of chuckled at them and let them all sit out there, a lot of crazy stuff. And I was amazed over time to watch how effective this turned out to be. And what the key to it, I think, is that they were, by not being explicit and by being murky, they were letting consumers kind of fill in the blanks. And different kinds of consumers who would not normally unite around the same product or brand were all partaking of Red Bull. And, you know, these ranged from sort of extreme sports situations to nightclubs to, you know, just giving the office workers, college students in different scenarios. And you see what the upshot is today. We've seen Red Bull move into this very unusual situation where it's a product that's available, you know, in a nightclub, in a gym, at your Kroger, at your convenience store, in your office refrigerator. And it still seems to make sense for everybody. So it turned out that marketing, I made up the word because I just thought it was sort of a funny riff on, you know, this one unusual, weird case. But in the long run, I think that they actually hit on something that it was very much forward-thinking in terms of how things are marketed now and will be marketed in the future.
So are we in partnership then with brand managers?
Well, I don't think that we're consciously in partnership with them, but I think that the strategy that Red Bull employed entirely depended on consumers being sort of willing, whether consciously or not, to participate in making up the meaning of this thing. So with taurine, for example, I talked to a number of and have looked at a number of studies and so on, like what exactly is the effectiveness of this ingredient, and consensus is pretty much universal that it doesn't really do much of anything. And there was an interesting comment from someone at Coca-Cola Company, because, of course, everyone has come out with other energy drinks now, and they all contain taurine. And someone at Coca-Cola was saying that they make no functional claims for it whatsoever, but the consumer simply demands it.
Mm. Well, what is taurine? Does anybody know?
It's something produced by the body naturally anyway. And it's, so it's just a, you know, it's a, I guess it's an amino acid, I believe. And, you know, they say that Red Bull claims that it does have some functional benefits. But most of what it appears from most of the more rigorous studies that have been done of it, that most of the kick you get from Red Bull is just a caffeine.
Mm. And here again, I want to get a little bit more at this, what's going on. Are the people who came up with the Red Bull campaign, are they essentially putting out dots on a canvas and then we fill it in or we make the connections ourselves?
Yeah, I think that that's exactly it. And I think that there's a kind of, you know, what's interesting is that over time, as I was working on the book, you can sort of see this in all kinds of cases. In some, it's more explicit than others. And, you know, I tell in the book the story of Pabst Blue Ribbon, the beer, which became, which was sort of a dying brand and started to turn around 5 or 6 years ago. And even the people at PBR, as they call it, couldn't figure out what was going on and had to dispatch someone to, you know, talk to the people who were now the young people who were now sort of taking up the brand, and found that they had kind of adopted it as this sort of anti-brand symbol because it was not really advertised and it seemed to be sort of moribund. And they saw it as something sort of more authentic than a Budweiser, which hammers you with advertising all day long. So it became a kind of anti-brand brand. And that was a meaning completely come up with by consumers and projected onto this thing. The company ended up going with it because it was better than anything they had working. But it wasn't something that they, you know, so that sort of habit of projecting these meanings onto things is something that seems to now come naturally to us.
Yeah. Another interesting product as canvas is Hello Kitty, which you also write about in the book.
Yeah.
A cultural symbol and a successful brand.
Well, it's a great case study in this. I borrowed from this a scholar named Brian McVie who looked in some depth at Hello Kitty. He uses this term projectability, which is exactly the stuff that we're talking about, that it's essentially a blank canvas upon which different people project different meanings. And I don't want to go too far with the word meaning because I'm not suggesting that, you know, the meaning might just be that's cute or that's campy or that's ironic or something along those lines. And Hello Kitty, you know, they make a big deal out of the fact that she has no mouth as being key to this. I don't know if there is something that you can really isolate that says, here's the key to this drawing that made it so successful. I really think that the key comes from us. The company that owns Hello Kitty, Sanrio, has done hundreds of other, they call them characters. Hello Kitty's not really a character. There's not much of a backstory. She's never had any adventures or anything. But they've done this hundreds of times in attempting to recreate the success of Hello Kitty, and they've never come close.
Yeah. Well, I went to the Sanrio website and looked up Hello Kitty for her bio.
Mm-hmm. And she has a sister. There's a few facts you can get.
She weighs the same as three apples. And she's cheerful and warm-hearted.
Yeah.
And baking cookies is what she likes to do. But what she really enjoys most, eating a slice of Mama's apple pie. Perfect.
And that's, but the interesting thing is, like, you can go find that stuff if it interests you, and but obviously the huge majority of people who have a Hello Kitty whatever, purse, T-shirt, platinum card, there is a Hello Kitty platinum card, don't know anything about that stuff. And all of the meanings of Hello Kitty came from, it's not like sort of Charlie Brown or Mickey Mouse where you saw a movie or a cartoon and you empathized with the character and therefore you decide to hang on to that in some way. There is no sort of master narrative beyond, yeah, she likes cookies or whatever.
Yeah. Well, according also to the company, she has a twin sister, Mimi.
Yeah.
So
the
now,
is on the other side, I think.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So somebody could come up to me and say, oh, you've got Hello Kitty there. And I could say, no, this is Mimi.
Yeah. Well, and you might be able to connect with the other hardcore Hello Kitty fans who've really dug into the lore.
I'm just surprised that that kind of thing exists. It's on the one hand, it's fun and it is cute and it's cool and it's camp all at the same time. But, you know.
Yeah, well, that's the mystery of it. And I think that it, you know, there's no, I don't think you can come up with a really rational explanation for that. It's just, you know, I think that I talk in the book a fair amount about human beings and symbols, and we have a kind of tendency to want to distance ourselves from the idea that we have an interest in or susceptibility to symbols. But it's actually a fairly human trait that symbols have some meaning to us, and that if we and if it's not there, sometimes we'll project it. We'll come up with the meaning ourselves.
Yeah, you say maybe symbols are something we not only enjoy, but we also desire them, and we may even need them.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, sometimes people, I think that what I learned or what I concluded after spending a lot of time in the wilds of branding and so on is that we sometimes think that, well, the world is so soaked with logos and that's why we're susceptible to these things. But maybe it's the other way around. Maybe it's that we have some kind of need for symbols and that's why logos sometimes catch on.
Yeah. They sure do. I mean, if you just look around you on the street, you know,
sure,
you'll see, you know, you'll see a mermaid about to maybe close up shop. You know, there's a mouse on somebody's T-shirt, a Mickey Mouse, the swooshes of our sneakers,
yeah,
and T-shirts and whatnot. So
well, there's a lot of interesting stuff in the news right now about, you know, you mentioned the mermaid closing up shop. That
Save
of the
Our Starbucks.
The Save Our Starbucks stuff. And people are I've read stories where people are essentially saying, like, well, it's a symbol of prosperity for this neighborhood. It's a symbol of progress for this neighborhood, so we don't want to lose it. And that's such a sort of extraordinary thing that we're at a point where, you know, it's a chain of coffee stores, and but it still clearly has this kind of and the truth is if they're closing it down, it's not a very accurate symbol of prosperity in your neighborhood, but the symbol of hope or status. I've seen people actually use the word status. That's powerful stuff.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Rob Walker. He writes the Consumed column for the New York Times Magazine, and he's the author most recently of Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now, a listener in Marshall on line four. Hi.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting show. Just as a follow-up real quick to your guest with regards to Red Bull, this was a couple years ago, and I stopped at a rest area on an interstate, and there's two young people in their 20s. And just struck up a conversation with me, and they go, oh, here, by the way, here's a can of Red Bull. Have you ever tried it? And I'm like, what are you doing? You know, you're selling me stuff in the rest area. I just, to follow up on what you were saying, it was a very, I thought, very unique method of marketing a product. But what I was hoping your guest could speak of real quick is a phenomenon as far as marketing where the scales at some point get tipped, And everybody has to have the same thing because it's popular. And what I'm talking about here is something like Cabbage Patch Dolls, something like that, where all of a sudden it catches on kind of like a wildfire, and everyone wants to, you know, get on the bandwagon, be part of a winning team. And, of course, now you can go to the store and the Cabbage Patch Dolls sit there by themselves. So I was just wondering, is there a method, an equation where, you know, people are going for that one more consumer that's going to turn the product into, you know, wildly successful? And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Yeah, well, there's two interesting examples of that that show some contrast both of which I actually talk about in the book. But one that is kind of more in line with what you're talking about, I think, would be the Livestrong bracelets, the yellow bracelets associated with the Lance Armstrong Foundation. That for a moment there, they were literally, the demand got so high for those that they couldn't keep up with it, and people were selling them on eBay, which, you know, the point of these bracelets was that some of the money went to the Lance Armstrong Foundation. And the idea of buying one for $10 off of eBay when none of the money would go to the Lance Armstrong Foundation just showed that that was a complete, it had transcended its own idea, basically, because it had hit that fad stage. Mm-hmm. And yes, marketers are constantly looking for that, and there are tons of theories about, well, you need to identify this certain kind of person, and they call them an influencer or a whatever, and this is the person that we all fall in line behind. I have sort of mixed feelings about that. Usually when something like that catches on, what marketers who try to recreate it later ignore is just the basic, is culture, essentially, that people have looked at the writing that I've done on PBR and tried to say, well, how can we recreate that with our brand? And the truth is that it was a unique time and place. In addition to whatever the company did to get it going or to amplify it when it kept going or when it started out, there are just cultural factors. But the other example is the iPod that I talk about in the book. And that's one that has done what they really want to do, what marketers really want to do, is have the thing catch on, go from being something that, remember when the iPod was unique and you only knew one person who had one and it was really interesting, and then to become, in effect, the standard in its class of product, where that's what, if you're going to get an MP3 player, people just talk about them as iPods in an almost generic way. You know, it'll say what are your favorite songs on your iPod, and it doesn't matter whether you have an iPod or not. They're just talking about it as a sort of category of good at this point, and somehow they've hung on to that status. This kind of chic status, despite the fact that it is easily the dominant product in the category, and it does not appear to be a fad.
Yeah. One of the things you mentioned, iPod, and one of the things that you write about in the book is in a section of the book on do-it-yourselfers and crafters, there's a website called Etsy.com.
Yep.
And tell us about these folks and what happens when you type iPod into the site's search engine.
Well, Etsy.com is a site that is, in some ways, it's analogous to eBay in the sense that there are a lot of individuals selling there. But in the case of Etsy, they are crafters and people who make various things. And they make, you know, anything from ceramics to sweaters to, you know, whatever. And one of the things that and they're all individuals, there are upwards of 100,000, I think, now, of these people selling on Etsy. It's a very popular site. And the ethos of it is, I think it's all things handmade or something along those lines. And the ethos of it is very much kind of a response to mass culture and a response to mass manufacturing and so on, buying a handmade good. So it is interesting that if you do type in iPod, and I haven't done it lately, but whatever I say in the book, more than 1,000 hits, I think, on people making little cozies and sleeves for your iPod. So you can get both things that way. You have the mass thing that everyone has, you know, so you sort of fit in and you have the right product on your MP3 player. But then you can be a little bit different by having a unique handmade little pouch to keep your iPod in.
Are these folks having an impact on the larger culture?
I think that the craft scene, I think that they are speaking to something and responding to something that's very real, and I think that they have a potential to have a really interesting impact. And what I think that they're responding to is exactly the stuff I was talking about, where there is a kind of, yearning almost for some more personal connection around consumer behavior, where so much of what we deal with in the marketplace, we don't know how it's made, we don't know who made it and under what conditions. It's very difficult to get that information. And we do care about this stuff more and more, I think. We want our consumer decisions, which are real and which have real impact in the world, as we're all learning, as we every time we learn something new about the latest ecological disaster, we want our decisions to be sound, and it's very difficult to do that. And when you're buying from another human being, even if you're doing it online, you can ask those questions, you can get that information, and you can make a more personal connection. Now, not everyone who's going to Etsy is thinking about all that stuff. I think a lot of the creators are. I think some of the people who go to Etsy just see, like, well, that's cute, and you know, on a blog somewhere, and they go and buy it. But then maybe it draws them into this other kind of conversation about the deeper impacts of consumer behavior that I think is really interesting and potentially could have some impact going forward.
Oh, another thing that's interesting to maybe think about a little bit here, and I've got another caller who would like to talk with you, so we won't make them wait too long here, but those folks who are on Etsy as the creators, there are lots of folks coming together, knitting groups, reading groups, cooking groups, church groups. I mean, that's something that goes back, way back. Coming together in communities with shared purpose. So it's, you know, that also is different. That's different from feeling a connection through a brand of something.
Yeah. I mean, clearly what's unusual about that situation, that scene, the craft DIY handmade scene, is that it's a response to material culture and materialism, but material culture and materialism are right in the middle of it as well. It is communing around things. Things are part of the game or part of the scenario. And you can have, I can understand why someone might have mixed feelings about that. But on the other hand, having surveyed the marketplace pretty extensively, I think that it's somewhat the most realistic source of optimism that I was able to isolate.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Rob Walker, author of Buying In. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello, yes. As you described marketing, it reminded me a lot of the Obama campaign, because it seemed like he was certainly for change, and then perhaps a lot of us kind of filled in the blank as to specifically what that change might be. And as we find out more about the candidate, for example, his FISA vote and things like that, it might be not the change we imagined. And my question is, could there be a backlash as we assume this is going to be what this product or candidate is going to be, and it's not, then there might be a even more worse backlash from that conflict or difference.
Yeah, you know, first I have to tell you that this some variation of this comes up almost every time I talk to people about the book. The Obama campaign is the Obama campaign an example of marketing, and people. There's definitely an element of what you're talking about there, of the projectability thing, where people did kind of fill in the blank themselves as to what this candidacy meant. I'm not sure. Well, first of all, clearly politics is different than people compare politicians to brands all the time, and have done so for some years. Politics are somewhat different in that at some point you have to answer the questions. You know, Red Bull can remain vague about taurine forever, and it doesn't really make any difference. At some point, a political candidate has to say, well, are you? I'm for this and I'm against that. Is there risk of a backlash? Possibly, but politics is also different because you only make your purchase once every 4 years in the presidential race, and you only have two choices, which is very different from the way every other consumer product category operates, where there's an infinite number of choices, and you're making them almost every week. So, yeah, there's a possibility, but I'm loath to make predictions about what might happen in the political sphere.
Yeah, I'm curious about the concept in general, because I've read up a bit about marketing, and they always talk about targeting your audience and being very specific about who you are. Do you find the products who have tried this a backlash in that they've, you know, tried to be very vague, and then they get defined in a way that doesn't work for them?
Yeah, I think that, an interesting category with that, actually, this is a little bit different, but in a broad way, I think that the way that some, I think that there's an element of this with the way that we think now about some pharmaceutical marketing, where for legal reasons they run advertising that they either have to run a lot of caveats or they have to be very vague and ask your doctor. And, we see the backlash happen when something goes awry and there's a class action lawsuit, which is kind of as bad as it gets in terms of a marketing situation. But with politicians, the thing that they kind of have in common always, this has always been true, I think, in the modern era anyway, with the way that some of these mass brands get built now, is that politicians are always cobbling together a lot of niche groups whose interests may conflict or at least be inconsistent with each other. And, you know, that's a key part of politics and political coalition building. And in some ways, brands are moving more in that direction just because the media marketplace is so fragmented now that it's the only realistic way to go. Is instead of saying, here's our one big consistent message, they kind of say, we'll have one message over here, one message over here, and one message over here. At least that's what I think Red Bull was up to.
Thanks
for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL and 333-WILL. Let's take another call from a listener in Urbana now, line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I don't know where this fits in your continuum, but drug ads, which actually say, you know, one of the side effects might be death. The first time I saw this, I was utterly amazed, and I was wondering how it ever got out of the conceptual phase and onto, you know, network TV.
Well, if they're telling the truth that one of the potential side effects is death, then that's all they have to do is disclose that and then tell you to ask your doctor. It's an unusual category, and I have to admit that I'm not an expert on pharmaceutical marketing. It is unusual in that the level of regulation around it is, for good reason, a lot more strict than around most consumer products. That said, those rules have been, pharmaceutical marketing is an interesting example of the fact that the advertising marketing works in the sense that since the rules have been loosened and you can advertise these things on television in various forms and go with what's called direct-to-consumer marketing, not just going through doctors, which is what used to have to be done, sales of various drugs have just exploded. It's been a huge boon for the pharmaceutical industry that they can advertise direct to consumers. And every time, it's one of the things I bring up whenever I talk to people who say, well, advertising, no one really pays attention to that stuff. None of it really works. Billions of dollars in sales in pharma would suggest otherwise.
Mm. When and how did you discover that you personally cared about brands more than you thought you did?
Yeah, so this is where I have to confess that, you know, I'm always picking on people who say that they don't have any, that they're immune to branding. And I was definitely one of those people. So I had this, you mentioned that I've been writing about this stuff to Slate, you know, for years. So as a reporter, you definitely see yourself as kind of above in some way whatever your subject matter is. You're an outside observer. And what happened was that Nike, the sneaker giant, bought Converse, the smaller sneaker company. And while, as a business journalist, I am amazed by Nike, I think they're an incredible success story, as a consumer, I'm definitely one of these people who would never wear Nike stuff. I found the swoosh, you know, was an example of this kind of, oh, people and their logos, it's so ridiculous, I don't want any part of that. However, I'd always worn Converse sneakers without ever really thinking about it. And this is a really key point that I always have to make to people, is that there was never a moment in my teens when I woke up one day and said, oh, I'm an individual, so therefore I'm going to go buy this brand of sneaker. I never thought about that stuff. A lot of this stuff happens on a non-conscious level. And it wasn't until I was sort of realizing, I'm not sure if I can continue wearing Converse sneakers anymore. And then I realized, I'm having this kind of crisis, this like existential crisis about the meaning of my sneakers. Maybe I'm not so immune to brand meaning after all. And that had a big effect on, you know, why I wrote the book, basically.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about your website, which I find very well done.
Thank you.
Merkening.com. There was a post earlier this month. In July of 2008, you posed this question: why is it that public service style marketing campaigns often seem so much less effective, less potent than marketing campaigns on behalf of a product or service? Interesting discussion ensued. You drew an interesting response from someone who works for an ad agency.
Mm-hmm.
What led you to ask the question, and what was Ben McAllister's response?
Well, I'm not sure how. I think that I had read there had been an article in the Times about
Febreze.
Yeah, and the Febreze stuff came up in the context of an article about a non-governmental organization that was devoted to basically getting people in developing nations to wash their hands
uh-huh.
more often to prevent the spread of disease, and they were having a trouble. Time getting this message around, and they ended up teaming up with some packaged goods giants like Colgate and Unilever and Procter & Gamble to sort of say, well, can you help us with this, you know, in the context of you selling soap? And they did, and it was apparently significantly more effective. So, and it did, it's a long time train of thought that I've had, that why is it that that kind of advertising, the sort of public service announcement, always seems so much less seductive, so much more of a lecture. And I asked the question of why do you think, and the one guy who weighed in said that he thought that the attachment of a product, of a basically a consumer decision to make, kind of makes all the difference, which is a fascinating assertion and something that I had wondered about many times, and I was interested to hear someone in the business having that point of view.
Yeah. Well, what do you think of the campaign of the Project of the Alliance for Climate Protection, the WE campaign, the We Can Solve It campaign?
You know, so far I don't think that much about it one way or the other. I think it's pretty early on that. I've seen sort of discussions of their logo and so on, and it's supposed to be a great logo. You know, I think that people – here's the thing about that stuff is that it's speaking to something real, and that there's a great deal of public interest and concern about the issues being addressed there. That organization is hardly the only one to be aware of that public interest. And among those organizations also aware of that public interest are every single consumer product company in
yeah.
the country. And they have, as a result – positively flooded the marketplace with symbols and images suggesting that if you buy this or that product, you are participating in solving the problem by buying this green, you know, something with a green logo or maybe just like a tree on it. And it unfortunately, I think that the volume of those messages far outweighs anything else and leaves the very troubling, in my opinion, general perception that shopping is somehow the way out of if you want to get involved, you need to go buy one of these cloth bags with a certain kind of logo on it, or you need to buy, you need to throw into your cart at the supermarket a green product this week, along with all the other stuff that you're buying, and that therefore you're doing your part. And there are lots of ways you can do your part that have nothing to do with buying more stuff. And that is, I guess, what this nonprofit is aiming at getting people to do. But it seems to be, for whatever reason, much harder to get people excited about participating in solving a problem in ways that don't have some kind of material component.
Hmm. I like those bags. There's my story. So,
well, there's certainly nothing wrong with having one of those bags, but it's debatable whether it's whether once you get one, you've done your part. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Well, it seems like everything is green and whole grain today.
Yeah, whole grain and natural.
Natural.
Natural is a word that gets used a lot because of the vague regulation around the ability to.
Well, this weekend I saw WALL-E, and before I saw the movie, I saw the merchandise. And it was so ironic. And I thought, here's another little telling thing about me. I went in to rent a movie, and there is a little model of WALL-E for sale.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, isn't he cute?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I didn't buy him.
Mm-hmm.
But then I go to the movie, and I'm sitting there, and everything is by and large, by and large. That's the corporate entity that owns and ruined the world, right?
Uh-huh.
So you get out of the movie, and it's a wonderful film. I really enjoyed it very much, but I thought, now that's weird. The message of the film is save the earth, and the message of the film is, one of the messages of the film is that need for connection, which we were talking a little bit about earlier, the, you know, communities, a shared purpose. And you know, here there's merchandise to
well, and you know, licensed movie merchandise is a really stark example. I talk, I guess, in the book about I repeatedly use T-shirts as an example of just a blank slate commodity that really you're not buying the T-shirt, you're buying the symbol that's on the T-shirt, and this is one of the ways you add. If you know, there's you can have a plain white T-shirt, and then you can have a plain white T-shirt with a picture of WALL-E on it. And it's a completely different item that probably commands a higher premium, simply because it you can express your solidarity with all those nice thoughts about community and saving the world by buying that T-shirt.
Yeah, are there generational differences in how we respond to the pitches made to us as consumers? Are young consumers more or less likely to embrace brands, or are they like those of us who are a little older?
Well, I think yes and no, in that I think that on the one hand, younger people are always going to tend to be more interested in ways of expressing identity, and because they're in the process of building identity. You know, when you're younger, you're still figuring out who you are, and I think that that is always true. And that as you the older that you get, the more you sort of answer some of those questions and you become less interested in trying on new identities and so on. Having said that, I think that a more gradual change is just simply that every generation grows up in an increasingly more commercially saturated environment, and it becomes increasingly normal to them. And so when I write about younger people in a couple places in the book, what I essentially concluded is that on the one hand, they are somewhat resistant to mass brands and mainstream branding and so on. On the other hand, more interestingly, they're so conversant in the language of branding or the grammar of branding that many of them have, in essence, hijacked it for their own projects. A lot of these online craft sellers that we were just talking about are young people. I spoke to several young people for the book who have started brands of their own that they see as being more authentic and expressive, and they just treat branding as a form of culture just like writing a novel or starting a rock group. And I do think that that's new. I always try to be cautious about this in that I'm not suggesting that today's young people are some sort of alien species who are completely different. They're not.
No.
But they have, I mean, I think that, and the next generation will have grown up in an even more brand-saturated world. And it'll just, it's, I think it's become pretty normal for all of us. But the more that, if you've spent your entire life dealing with brand symbols in this way, it just isn't something that you would question the same way that someone who is older and remembers a different kind of public sphere might question it.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the Hundreds.
Well, the Hundreds are one of these brands, and these are smart guys in Los Angeles who I met several years ago. And at the time, I had no idea what would come of it. They were actually law school students, disgruntled law school students, but you wouldn't know it to meet them because they were just a couple cool kids, whatever, and they were stuck in law school and wanted to get out and wanted to start their own brand, which was called the Hundreds. They're in Los Angeles, and I would ask them, well, what is it all about? And they would say, well, it represents the Southern California lifestyle. Well, what does that mean? Well, skateboarding, you know, rap, punk, just these various vague just sort of signifiers. And what it basically seemed to boil down to was that the Hundreds lifestyle consisted in large part of buying the Hundreds brand. but they were very sincere about it, and they have a lot of integrity in the context of what they're doing, in the sense that they're not just being cynical manipulators who are just, well, let's figure out what the kids want and give it to them. They were doing what they wanted to do and saw real distinctions between how it would be done right and how it would be done wrong. And they had no marketing training at all, but they just seem to come to it quite naturally. And as it turned out, I didn't know this when I started following them, but they've been actually quite successful. They now operate, they have a store in Los Angeles and a store in San Francisco, and they're doing really well.
Yeah. And the founder of Etsy, Robert Kalin, is 20-something.
Yeah, he's also a very young guy and very, very interesting,
uh-huh.
Very interesting person with a very kind of skeptical take on mass culture and on he blames baby boomers actually for the spread of mass culture if I remember his critique.
Yeah, that's
correctly.
Right. Blame it on the hippies.
He's joking, but he didn't blame them. But I mean, he sort of sees a kind of backlash that his generation is a part of via his site, and it's an interesting critique because on the one hand, I think that the branding sophistication of the people who are working through that site is very high. On the other hand, those folks do tend to be working with their hands and in a one-to-one way and do have a bit of an ideology to what they're doing.
Hmm. You know, we have the remote, we have the TiVo, we have the web, we have YouTube. How are technologies affecting branding and what we buy?
Well, the main response to that question tends to be that it has empowered consumers, and especially TiVo. When TiVo came along, it really sent shockwaves through the advertising industry in terms of something that could let you zap past commercials. Seemed like a big threat. And an empowering tool to consumers, along with all these other clicky things. So what I try to argue for in the book, though, is that on the other hand, it has, in the long run, I think, empowered marketers. And what I mean by that is that they weren't just going to call up their clients and say, well, we're all out of business now because no one will watch 30-second commercials anymore. What they said was, we have to come up with other ways of getting our message in front of consumers. And that Red Bull stuff is an example, like the caller who had was accosted by Red Bull reps at a truck stop, mm-hmm. or whatever it was. You know, real life becomes a good place to get at people. I talk in the book quite extensively about the rise of what are called word-of-mouth marketing agencies that essentially work on a volunteer model where you sign up, get products free in advance on the sort of promise that you'll talk them, if you like them, you'll tell your friends and neighbors about them, which introduces the idea that your trusted friend is now sort of, in effect, a marketing medium. And that's you know, that's a new phenomenon. That's not something to be organized to the extent. And these, some of these agencies have hundreds of thousands of volunteer members.
Are they really doing that, though?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, you read the book. There's there's plenty of examples of people showing up at the barbecue and with the one buzz agent gets reports back from, you know, that's how you get your sort of status within the buzz agent community is how much buzzing you're doing. So they send the reports back to HQ talking about, you know, going up to the, you can leave a suggestion card at your grocery store. You can talk to people who are also shopping at the grocery store. There was the woman who, you know, mentioned to her local priest that he might want to use this brand of sausage in his white Tuscan bean soup. So, I mean, it's something new and different, and I must say that I'm not, the people who are involved in it definitely don't see themselves as doing anything problematic at all. They see themselves as giving their honest opinion. And I'm, you know, I'm sure that that's how they see it. I think that there are some basic psychology things that go on there when you get something first, and its significance kind of depends on you getting other people to go along with it. There's some basic psychology at work there where they're kind of playing off our desire or the pleasure of being a trendsetter, and they're kind of leveraged that, which I think is natural human tendency, but it's just never been organized to an extent that it is now. And I think that that's an indirect result of TiVo and all these other technologies that were supposed to put us in control.
Beware of Hello Kitty burying cookies. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Rob, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Rob Walker is the author of Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. The book is published by Random House, and you'll find our guest at his website, Merketing.com.